I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory.
Not just stadiums, hundreds of streets in Catalonia and squares are probably named after US companions and other Republican leaders. The more and more that's being done, the more and more, and all this new memory law, or moving Franco from the Valley of the Fallen, and all those other things that have happened, the more the right has reacted. So I think when things were not much was talked about, you know, that's okay. But the more and more it's brought out into the open, to clean the democratic space. You know, how could you have a state where there's 115, 120,000 people in mass unmarked graves from just three generations ago? How can you have a state? How can you have a democratic conversation with that skeleton in the cupboard there? My name's Nick Lloyd. I've been living in Barcelona for about 38 years now. I can't remember now. I've lost track. And I'm a historian and guide on the Spanish Civil War in the city. That's how I make my living. I've written two books, one, Forgotten Places, which is part a history of the war and part a guidebook to the war, which came out some years ago. And I've just completed, coming out in November, my second book, which is, as it says on the tin, really, travels through the Spanish Civil War. It's me traveling through the Spanish Civil War today.
Nick, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Pleasure to be here, Richard. It's a really interesting podcast you've got.
So happy to have you, Nick. Again, this is a unique episode for me because up until now, I've just been reading books and talking to authors. And I had a chance not just to read your book on the memory of the Civil War in Barcelona, but to take your tour, which was the highlight of my trip to Barcelona. And so I've tried to organize my questions around a combination of the book and the tour. And I thought, well, your tour and your book really focuses on the recovered memory of the Civil War, but primarily from the Republican side. And I thought maybe it might be interesting to begin with the winning side. You know, I'm living in a country where the winning side is now getting to tell its story in its own way. So it's Franco's side that wins the Civil War, and they run the country for the next 40 some odd years. So how do they remember the Civil War? What do they decide to cut out? What do they decide to commemorate? What narrative do they put together for this past?
Yeah, and that's a very important question. And just to go backwards for a moment, I mean, people have said that the whole cliche about war being written by the history of a war being written by the victors, while in Spain it's been said that the history of the war was written for the defeated by historians outside, beginning with Hugh Thomas and later Paul Preston and people like that. And then Spanish and Catalan authors really picked it up with the arrival of democracy. But, of course, Franco won the war, as you said, and really was obsessed with the memorialization across Spain, across Spanish territory. I don't know how many there are, how many memorials. There are thousands of memorials to Franco in one way or another. These go from, of course, the famous, most famous, infamous of them all, Valley of the Fallen, Franco's memorial grave outside of Madrid, to every region, every province has got its own little Valley of the Fallen, in a sense, where local dignitaries would go and remember on certain dates the victory, down to almost every single church would be emblazoned with the name of José Antonio, the founder of the Fascist Falange, who was executed by the Republic in 1936. He was seen as a martyr, so that would be on every single church, which means in almost every single village. And these memorials really covered the whole of the country and would be used on certain dates to ram home the victory, really. Also, we should say at a wider point that the Franco regime divides the population into victors and defeated, the defeated and those who died on the defeated side are not worth remembering in any way. They are scum and barbarians, etc. Whereas the victors and those who died are absolutely seen as being remembered. So it doesn't just divide the living population. The Franco regime actually also divides the dead population into good Spaniards and bad Spaniards, manifested through all of these memorials and monuments across the country. I think that other forms of fascism, Francoism, is described as a massive cult of the dead.
Okay, so I mean, there could have been, this was a decision that was made, there could have been an effort to try to rally the country together around some kind of unifying theme, but the way you're describing memory working under the Franco regime, it was a retribution approach. It was not let's find a way to pull the country together after this divisive civil war.
Yeah, retribution is an excellent idea. An excellent word, sorry. Not an idea. Yeah. It was another way of punishing, in fact, to say that, you know, you cannot, those who lose, you know, you will not be allowed to remember your dead. Your dead will stay unmarked in roadside graves and in mass graves. And our dead will become martyrs. Yeah. To award those who won and to punish those who lose.
So you're kind of getting into my next question. Well, Franco dies in 1975, and this is the 50th anniversary of his death. And you could ask the question, well, it's been 50 years since his death, nearly 50 years since Spain has transitioned to a democracy, about 90 years since the Spanish Civil War started. Almost everybody involved is no longer alive. Why does this matter? Why do people still care? And in what ways does it still matter? Does it matter more in Barcelona?
Well, it's strange because it seems to matter more now than some years ago. There was a point, perhaps in the early 2000s, when I started out becoming very interested in the war, actually, that it looked like, you know, we were moving towards some form of reconciliation, in the sense that, you know, I always think that when your own grandfather, and you're not going to want to talk ill of him probably, but when it gets to the point of great grandparents, it shouldn't really matter anymore, that people should be able to talk honestly. And it seemed that things were going in that direction. Like, so the Partido Popular, which is the conservative party in Spain, which grew out of the Franco regime but has the pretense of being a liberal conservative party, and it actually went as far as denouncing the 36 coup. And it seemed that, you know, we were moving in a direction where more and more, where you could talk about things honestly and there wouldn't be a kickback from the Spanish nationalist right. But that really has completely gone out the window in the last 10, 15 years. And every year it's getting worse and worse. And the Francoism and the Spanish Civil War, etc., are becoming very much points of, in a wider memory, in a wider cultural war. Yeah. And the line is often, both sides, I mean, the classic traditional conservative line, which has got, I think, a bit stronger in recent years, is both sides did bad things, let's not talk about it. Yeah. And it's true, both sides did bad things. But one side did nothing but talk about it for 37 years. They were reminded, the Spanish population was reminded who won and who lost for 37 years during the Franco dictatorship. And that line is still there. I mean, to the point where Feijóo, the president of the Partido Popular, is the leader of the opposition in Spain, he said last year, he described the civil war as a merely as a punch up between our grandparents, you know, something that led to, I think it's 600,000 lives during and hundreds of thousands of lives lost after. Describing that as a punch up is a bit, it's quite a big thing to say, that, isn't it? And that's all there, that, you know, minimizing things and saying let's not talk about it. But we've now got, and I suppose I'm jumping past your question, into a much worse situation since the rise of the ultra-right, the far-right, Vox, which is actually very much infecting the whole of the conservative sphere of Spain, or most of it, with a few exceptions, which is not just adequately condemning the coup, it seems to be out and out supporting the coup. And there's this really quite nasty memory war going on in Spain now, and it's getting worse and worse, really. I mean, you could say there are parallels. I don't want to go too far in this, but parallels with, you know, Me Too and women's rights, etc., around the world. You know, that the more that, you know, women, you know, demand the right to be treated as equally as human beings, you know, some men are recently kicking back more and more against that. And I think it's the more and more victims of the Franco regime, or the descendants of the victims, or the representatives of the victims of the Franco regime, denounce this, a very strong element of the Spanish nationalist right feels emboldened to fight against it. And they use it as part of this memory war. But I've probably answered two questions in one there, no?
So that's fascinating, Nick. I would not have thought that again, your perspective is coming from someone living in the country for how long now? Is 25 years or longer? How long have you been?
No, I've been living, right in 88. How long is that? I'm not very good at maths. I think is it 30?
A lot of years.
A lot of years. A couple of years in Aragon, a couple of years elsewhere in Catalonia, and the rest in Barcelona.
So you are really seeing the country firsthand, and your feeling is that it was actually more open about the past in the past, or maybe...
Not when... Certainly not when I arrived.
Maybe not...
No, not when I arrived, no. People were...
We're more divided about it today than it was in the past.
Okay. Right, that's a complex one. Okay, so let's say when I arrived, I don't think it was very open. Some people would talk about it, some people wouldn't. It wasn't that nobody would talk about it. That's absolutely the case. But then I think around about the 2000s, which is when I really coincidentally became fascinated with this, or maybe it's not coincidentally because it was in the zeitgeist perhaps, because a few plaques started to be brought up, which was, you know, which led to me asking questions about things to myself. Then, you know, there were a few documentaries being shown on television, on Catalan television, and friends were starting to talk about their grandparents and great uncles in the war. It was something in the zeitgeist, in Catalonia at least, in the early 2000s, that, you know, that people were starting to discuss things more openly. And where are we now? It's not that those people are not talking about things openly. They're probably talking about things more openly than ever. But part of the population, who I have to say I don't have much contact with, are perhaps in the first few years were quiet about it. Now they're absolutely not quiet about it. So, you know, just to repeat that, I think there's a strong, I don't want to put percentages, but there's a strong group of Spanish people who are absolutely prepared to talk about the war and discuss it. And then there's another part which is not, or is now becoming visceral in talking against, you know, memory politics.
So was it fair to say that in general, there's more conversation there was in the past, but as the country has opened up and has started talking about it, it's become even more divided over time? Yeah. About this past. And I did read, I mean, this is the 50th anniversary of Franco's death, and the two leading conservative parties want nothing to do with these commemorative efforts.
No, well, they wouldn't. Well, you could imagine Vox yes, wanting to do with different commemorative efforts and celebrating Franco's life. PP perhaps a little bit more uncomfortable, but even the PP is divided between a more liberal and more ultra wing. And in that ultra wing, there's a lot of people who are hardline Franco, who, you know, who now it's become politically acceptable on the right again to talk about Franco. Some of their opinions, which they probably kept to themselves through the 80s and 90s, really, you know, are becoming acceptable again in the public sphere. And also young people, that's a strange one. Young people becoming, you know, talking about Franco and the regime. And that's something you wouldn't have expected a few years ago. I mean, you know, it's always the small minorities, but it's not that anymore. It's becoming bigger.
Okay, so your own introduction to this past is somewhat coincidental, right? There's a plaque, there's a library that opens up in a neighborhood you happen to move into, and that seems to trigger your interest in it. So
it is, but
what's
is
the
it,
significance?
Yeah, well, is it coincidental, as I was thinking when I was talking? Because, of course, because it was in the zeitgeist of putting up plaques with, okay, look, just to introduce that to people, what happened was, I think it's 25 years ago now, 20-odd years ago, Barcelona City Council put up a little plaque 30 metres from where we lived to the house where a man called Francesc Boix was born. And shortly afterwards, or at the same time, they opened our new local library, which was named after him. And I just became fascinated with this man, this young man, Francesc, and what he did. Not so much during the war, but after the war. And basically, very short version of this, he's a photographer in the Republican Army during the war. He's very young. He's 16 at the start, 19, I think, when he leaves, goes into exile in France in 39. He's then conscripted to build the Maginot Line along with thousands of other Spanish Republicans when it looks like Germany's going to invade. Germany invades the north of France. He's captured along with thousands of other Spanish Republicans. He's deported eventually to the hell of Mauthausen in Austria, amongst the worst of all SS work camps, where I think it's about 100,000 people are worked to death as slave labourers or forced labourers. But because he's a photographer, he gets a relatively good job working in the SS photo labs as a slave. Yeah. As a forced labourer, not developing the photographs, not taking the photographs, but developing all the horrible photographs the SS are obsessively taking of everything. And then him and a few others, they steal the photographs and pass them to a bunch of young Spanish lads, really, they're very young, 13 to 16 or something. The only ones they allowed outside to work in a private quarry, and they pass them to a very brave Austrian woman and appoint her, and she hides them in a garden wall. And those photographs today represent the largest photographic record of the barbarity of the SS camps while ongoing, because the Nazis destroyed almost everything when they knew they were going to lose. And there is famously, apparently, more photographs from Mauthausen than all the other camps put together, thanks to this task performed by these young Spanish lads. And because of that, he later becomes, and this is what it says on the plaque, the only Spaniard called to declare at Nuremberg against the Nazis. And he helps to convict, for example, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, the highest ranking SS official, to be convicted, thanks to his testimony of the photographs. And I just became fascinated with this whole story. But going back to what you said before, you see, yes, it's coincidental, but no, it isn't, because, although I didn't know that then, because it was in the zeitgeist, because, you know, the Times were saying, put up plaques, start to remember people. And, for example, the library they opened up, which is literally just around the corner, I mean, that's a fascinating place. It's a normal it's named after him. It's a normal public library, but we've got nice big posters of the war around there. And every library in Barcelona has a big, excellent, excellent public library system. And I'm in the UK at the moment this summer, and here the public libraries have just been decimated in the last 20 years, whereas in Barcelona it's the opposite. They're getting better and better. And every public library, little rabbit hole, has its own specific. It's got the normal stuff, your kids' stuff and novels and whatever, but it also has a specific collection. So one library might be on travel, one library might be on ancient history or whatever. And our library is on the Holocaust and the Spanish Civil War, bringing the two stories together through the experience of Francesc Boix. And without that plaque and without that library, which was created because of this zeitgeist in the early 2000s, I'd never have started down the path.
Oh, it's interesting. I would not have known that. So it's not just the plaque. It's not just a library named after the only Spaniard to testify in the Nuremberg trials. It's actually dedicated to it's dedicated to the Civil War, dedicated to the Holocaust. There's somebody who's collecting books on that, and you're coming across as you're being introduced to this past by having access to those books that maybe you'd already been in the country for over a decade. It couldn't have happened a decade earlier.
Yeah, to already been 15 years in the country. Yeah. And also there's a lot we do. There's a lot of talks at the library too. And you know, it is a place of discussion of the Civil War and memory politics and the Franco regime. So that was all very helpful. It started me off. Without that, I don't think I would have ended up. You know, it's things happen, don't they, in life that you don't expect.
So it's part of the context. There's more interest in commemorating, in writing about, in providing access to this past. How novel is the work that you're doing then, that you set out to discover these forgotten places of the Civil War in Barcelona? Are you alone? Are there a lot of other people doing the same thing? How difficult is it to dig up this past, to get people to talk about it at that time?
No, I don't think it's difficult. When I started out, it was perhaps harder because there was relatively little online, and there were a lot of books, but some of them were a bit confusing about where places were. And so I had to go a bit more into the archives. Now it's there on a plate if you want to look for it. There's just so much material online that there wasn't 25 years ago. Well, I think it's a lot easier now. I mean, I called my book Forgotten Places, Barcelona and the Spanish Civil War, because nobody seemed to know where places were. Everyone I asked, people did know, but gave contradictory information. Now I don't think that's the case. I think there always has been an awful lot of brilliant local historians in Barcelona, but it's been documented a lot better online now, and there's a lot of very good books out. So I think it's something starting out now, it would be easier.
Reading your book and taking your tour, there's this theme of, well, maybe there weren't many of them, but there are certain street names that are still there from that were boarded up, that were discovered, that had somehow survived the decades of the dictatorship. I mean, how many remnants of that past were there within plain view and people just weren't paying any attention to it? Were they there and people just didn't know about it?
No, there's two, and neither were in plain view. One of them was a board on a church, which covered up. There was a board on an advertising board, I think, on a church, which covered up something. And when the church was renovating, especially the P, they pulled off the board, and this remarkable remains from 36. We know it's from 36 because of newspapers at the time and photographs from 36. And it says Placido Militia Disconegut, Square of the Unknown Militiamen, reminding of the role of the militias at the start of the war against Franco. Of course, and then there's another one else in Barceloneta. And both of those were kind of hidden or concealed. And it's only in recent years that they have been recovered. I mean, when I arrived in Barcelona, and even when I started researching this, there were a lot more marks from bombs. There's far fewer now because I don't think it's a purposeful erasing the past. It's just that people have been cleaning up buildings, you know, shearing things up. I mean, it was never Berlin anyway. We should not exaggerate in any way, but was it? And when I arrived, there were no ruins from the war, but there certainly were more marks from shrapnel on the side of buildings. And there are some still, but far fewer than there were. But, I mean, there's a lot more memorialization than was when I started out. So there might have been, some plaques, a number of plaques. Now I try to count them, and it's very difficult because there's different organizations do things, but there's probably 150 to 200 municipal anti-fascist plaques in Barcelona, municipal or otherwise. That might be to the bombing, it might be to famous people on the Republic anti-Francoist side who lived somewhere or were murdered somewhere. It might be those in the mass grave. Or it might be remembering the international brigades, etc. There's quite a lot, but you've got to look for them. So there's
I guess I'm wondering, you know, when I think about the tour that I took, and you're pointing out the telecommunications building at the start of the tour, different sites along the tour, to what extent was there just no real memory because it hadn't been included in the education system, no real understanding of the significance of, oh, this is the hotel where George Orwell stayed at, or this was the headquarters of this Soviet-backed communist party. There was just a lack of, or this is where this particular event took place. Those sites were in plain view, but maybe people hadn't been educated about it, and they were living in the mist, but not really knowing.
There are a number of plaques. That's curious. There should be one of the old Communist Party headquarters. You're right, and it would be interesting one for the telephone exchange. What I am surprised about is there isn't one yet for the bullet marks in Plaza Catalunya. There's a friend of mine who, with the help of a ballistic expert from the police, did a study and found there's 88 or now eight. I think we saw some of them. 88 bullet marks in the square from the war, and that would be an interesting thing to commemorate. And I don't know, but I hope they're protected now. It's been piecemeal, Richard, but there's been a lot done. And you contrast that with Madrid, where very little in the short sort of centre-left government in Madrid. They did a few things. It was only a brief tenure they were in for. And when they lost the present conservative council, which is really on the right side of the Conservative Party, has erased many of these places. So compared with Madrid, at least, in Barcelona, there's an awful lot's been done. But no, there's never enough.
Okay. I guess I'm thinking, because I've had episodes on memory activists and the kind of grassroots work that gets done in places like Germany, for example, long before that becomes incorporated into a kind of a national memory culture. There are people out there trying to draw recognition to places that were part of the National Socialist past. And they do that work of keeping that memory alive. And then eventually it gets commemorated. Maybe eventually plaques go up. There's a lot of work.
That has definitely happened in Barcelona, for example. There's a whole, so, you know, all these from the early 2000s, the city council started putting up plaques. But previous to that, there were a series of different organisations, anarchists, for example, or socialist organisations, which put up plaques, a small number of plaques to those who'd lost the war in Barcelona. So in a sense, there had been a bit of groundwork. And there are a few I can think of where there's the old eccentric plaque from the 80s or 90s, and next to it now there's now an official city council plaque or information panel perhaps.
So one of the things that impressed me when I took your tour is how you helped, again, a group of people who were on your tour who hadn't been studying, preparing with a kind of base of knowledge to head into this past, how you were able to set this up. And it is a complicated history to set up the context of the time, the political groups at play, the ideologies. There is a lot, to look at this from a memory perspective, one of the challenges is just to peel back the layers of the present. And you start your tour, the tour I took in the Plaza Catalunya, and you are pointing out the significance of particular buildings and the place where the attempted coup was foiled. But you have to find a way to get people to see beyond the layer of the present. So how, and I think this is tying into the walking museum part of your tour, how you bring a lot with you to do this, to get people to see the past, but, and to understand it, but you also have to, I think for people to connect, you have to have some kind of common denominator. You have to get them to be able to relate to it through the lens of the present. And this gets into this relationship between memory and history. I had an episode where the author argues that history is always very different from memory. History is something you need to think about. History is like a foreign country, and you need to deal with it on its own terms. And the past is always about, the memory is always about understanding the past in terms of the present. Hmm. And so maybe you're trying to do both. Explain the history, but it's also memory, in that you've got to get people to find a way to understand it, to connect to it in terms of the present. And you've got to get them to see through the decades of change that have happened in the present. How do you do that? How do you try to set the stage so people can visualize that past?
Well, one way is, instead of it being a 3-hour tour, it's a 4-hour tour, because I need that extra bit to really lay it all down. And I don't take prisoners. I do hopefully give them a full bang. I kind of hopefully design it so it is of interest to somebody who knows absolutely no, I mean, if somebody's not interested in history or anything, well, you know, perhaps not, but if someone's got a vague interest in history but doesn't know anything about Spain, I'm hoping it's going to be interesting enough to draw them in. But I'm also hoping it's the same tour, the same people, interesting enough to somebody who's a, you know, an expert even in the Spanish Civil War but doesn't know about what happened in Barcelona. I think I'll design it perhaps following the ideas of a good documentary, which can be interesting on a number of levels. So that's why I'm using different visual aids and objects is a way of drawing people in. Another way of drawing people in is by telling personal stories, Francesc, who we just mentioned, but also others. So, you know, obviously you're talking for 4 hours, people are not going to pick up on everything, absolutely not, but some people will pick on some things and so other people will pick on other things. I think the war is perhaps easier than other conflicts to relate to people from outside, because it was such an international conflict. So I always start by asking where people are from, and that gives, you know, the opportunity to say, oh, really? Okay, there were 500 from Denmark, you're from Germany, we're 3,000 from Germany. Volunteers, sorry, you fought for the Republic, 2,800 for the United States. And, you know, I don't think there's been a war in history which has so has been such an international war waged in one country. Yeah. And it's, you know, there are so many books written about the Spanish Civil War. What's the figure? Is it 30,000? It's an extraordinary number. Don't quote me on that. I can't remember, but it's a lot. And, you know, there are hundreds of books probably written from an American perspective of the war. There's hundreds of books written from a French perspective. From, you know, and every country in Europe has its whole biography of the war, the Spanish Civil War, from different perspectives, which allows you to, you know, when people learn things in any topic, you know, often what you learn most efficiently, perhaps, when you already know things before, and then you tag on your new knowledge to that. So if I've got Americans, when I can, you can bring in Roosevelt, you can bring in a lot, you can bring in Hemingway, of course, you know, the easy ones. And there's always, or the fact that Oliver Law was the first African-American commander of an American fighting unit in the Abraham Lincoln Battalion. You know, there's ways you can bring things in to connect people to today just with the geography of where they're from, which you wouldn't get in another war or most wars. I think that's it. That's a good one. And, of course, because it affects current politics today in Spain so much, that's another one. And also the way it affects current Spain politics so much is not dissimilar to other memory conflicts taking place around the world. I'm sure you know a lot more about this than I do, but other memory conflicts around the world, which, you know, which are part of a wider cultural war. So that's another way. I mean, to be honest, you know, my mind's often just in the 1930s, but Americans are saying to me things like, oh, this is, you know, this is so much like American politics today. I don't know if it is or not, but they see it like that. So it's an easy sell, Richard.
So that's interesting. So it's not necessarily you making the connection to the present. It's the people who are on the tour, like me, who are doing that, who can't help but to think, oh, here we are with the rise of authoritarianism in Europe again today. And I don't know what are the parallels between today and the and what was happening in Spain during the 1930s? That you're not necessarily, your brain isn't not necessarily there.
Well, I don't want to ram things down people's throat. I prefer people to come to their own conclusions. And they may be the same conclusions I would come to, but I'm not going to tell them to do that.
And I did discover that you do this tour. You have done it in what, Castilian, in Catalan as well. That you've done this in the language
I don't do that tour anymore in Spanish or Catalan because, for one thing, Spanish, you need 30% more time because words are longer, there's more syllables. And two, I get a bit knackered after 2 hours of intense speaking. I mean, I get tired enough after 2 hours in English and my normal tour's 4. So I prefer not to do it, that one in Spanish or Catalan anymore. For 10 years, I did a separate tour to the mass grave for Barcelona City Council, well, really for the Barcelona cemeteries, the mass grave for the victims of the Franco regime in Barcelona, which is a very moving space, which I don't know if you visited, Richard. For me, it's the most remarkable space of historical memory in Spain. And I did that in Catalan once or twice a month for 10 years. It was very moving because 1,700 people are buried there, dumped there after being shot by the regime from 1939 onwards. And it's a very moving space. And, you know, frequently there'd be grandchildren or even children of men, in a few cases women who were executed. And that was in, I did that for 10 years. For family reasons, because it was the weekend that I stopped doing it. I'm also doing now more or less every month. A free tour. That was a free tour, and also doing a because the Bruskin government paid me. But now I'm also doing a sort of a voluntary tour now once a month in Catalan with a group of other Catalan historians, just on Francesc Bosch's story in Poble Sec, walking around the neighbourhood and talking about his story, and we end again with Manthausen. That's very much a local thing in Catalan about, you know, local history, really.
So is that a totally different experience? If you look at a tour of primarily English-speaking people like myself, and then you're giving it to locals in Catalan, is people's connection to that past, relationship to it, the interactions you have with them, what comes out of it, is it just night and day?
I wouldn't say it's completely different, because most, you know, many people from different countries also have histories of fascism and experience like fighting against fascism. You know,
I mean, if that past is personal, I guess that's what I'm getting at. If it's your past,
That's true. Although I'll build on that in a moment, but it's also true that a percentage of the people who come on my tour in English also have personal memories. I've had a lot of people who are descendants of hundreds, probably over the year, descendants of international brigaders from the United States, from Britain, but from all over Europe. And whose, you know, grandfathers, great uncles, or even sometimes fathers fought in Spain. All people from who in some way or other had helped in one way, their grandparents or parents had fought, helped the Republic. I mean, a small demographic within the American visitors are red diaper babies, you know, the children of communist parents from the 30s and 40s, and usually Jewish. But they are, you know, they're a small demographic amongst the Americans. And also quite a lot of people from the Spanish diaspora, because, you know, in 1939, so many people did escape. Many of them end up in Latin America and other countries, and then, you know, spread around the world. And they're another piece. And also, I do get, I don't know if other tours in English this happens, but I do get quite a few locals coming on the tour, even though it's in English, which is, I think it's a bit of an honour, actually. But, yeah, the tour I did to the mass grave, everyone's involved, everyone has a story, whether or not the, and, yeah, it got a bit heavy at times, ending in tears. I couldn't have done it more than once a month. You know, I always say that I could not be a guide at somewhere like Auschwitz. I could not do that. On my bit, the stories I tell, there's a tragedy, but there's also a bit of humour there, and there's, you know, and there's also there's pathos, but there's also struggle, and there's good stories. There's lots of things you can talk about, art and things. It's not all bad. In the mass grave, again, not all bad, but mainly, and I couldn't have done that more than once a month.
I guess my introduction to the memory of the Spanish Civil War, and I had an earlier episode on the democratic memory movement tied into forensics and Emilio da Silva's role in that. And the theme there was that forensics becomes a way to open up conversations, that you discover these masks. Everyone knows where the bodies are buried. That seemed to be, maybe that's an exaggeration, but for the most part, there's an awareness of where the mass graves are. It's not like in Argentina, my previous episode, where you talk about the disappeared, and maybe the military knows, but no one else knows. Mm-hmm. The military is keeping those cards hidden. There's an awareness, and forensics is a way of finding kind of a pseudo scientific neutral way of getting people to talk, that you set up that site And that becomes a kind of conversation piece to open up difficult, really difficult conversations that a lot of communities have never had. So I guess asking the question about the tours, I was kind of wondering, well, I wonder if Nick is playing that same bridge role, and if he does a tour in Catalan versus English, is it different there? Or is he getting people on his tours that are really, maybe they need that outlet because they really haven't had a chance to talk about even the Republican side. But is it a bridge? Does it ever serve as a bridge? Or is it a self-selected group of people that, that take that tour?
But that's a very good point. We're talking about the tours I used to do to the Masquerade, yeah? Which I stopped for personal reasons, for family reasons, because they were on Sundays and it was a bit problematic losing too many Sundays a year. There were days, Richard, when it felt real catharsis of like everyone's gone. Sometimes you'd do it and hardly anyone would say anything, but other days, you know, everyone would be there with stories and the people were queuing up in a way at the end to tell their story about what happened to their great uncle or aunt or something, or their mother. At times it felt like that, which I don't think generally touring English doesn't. There have been moments, absolutely there's been moments, but generally not. But often, even in the touring English, there's people do come along with stories which just knock you out about, you know, a Spanish grandfather and how he was arrested or escaped, things that happened to him. Yeah.
Because my sense is that was a country where for decades there was a kind of this heavy, thick climate of fear. And it's not an easy thing to, when you've been labeled as the enemy, and maybe you're even if that regime softens over time, it's still a regime based on the kind of history of terror, its background. There's this climate of fear that pervades that country for decades. It's not necessarily an easy thing for people to open up. Yeah. And talk about it.
I don't think you really experience that much now in Catalonia. And older people, yes. So those tours I was doing in Catalan, yeah. It was the older people who had this thing of having to get it off the chest. Well, for younger people, they might very well hate Franco and say so. Absolutely openly, but it's not, there's no catharsis involved because they've been taught it in schools, you know? And of course we're talking about Catalonia now, and that's not the whole Spain. You know, elsewhere, I mean there's people who do tours in Madrid and they don't have problems, but I'd feel uncomfortable about doing a tour in Madrid. And a friend of mine now, Modena Cross, who is the real expert on Spanish Civil War in Madrid, in tours, and she's wonderful. And she's been on my tour, and she says she wouldn't do it in the same way as I do it. Now, she's actually more visceral than I am, and she's even, you know what's, her colours are very clear. But she's more careful where she does things. She's not so openly on the street, which, you know, do I live in a little bubble? I do sometimes wonder. I mean, I hear horror stories of people going down to, tourists are coming on my tour, going on tours in Seville, just being shot by a guide who's, you know, evidently pro-Franco, which you really wouldn't get in Catalonia. You know, I think there's an overriding general anti-fascist, anti-Francoist consensus in Catalonia.
That's fascinating.
Elsewhere in Europe, you know, or there was, breaking down now, there seem to be elsewhere in Europe, where, of course, in the rest of Spain, it's kind of more divided, you know?
So if you're someone like me, you take the trip to Barcelona, you're there for a few days, you take the tour, and you get this incredible introduction to that past. You could easily leave the country without having that awareness that, well, that is an experience that you could get in Barcelona. That culture maybe is more open to talking about that past. It's done more, it's got a longer history of doing more commemorative work. But in other parts of Spain, there's still a long way to go. And that it, maybe you could have a similar tour, but it would have to be approached in a very different way. This much more self-censoring you'd have to do.
No, I don't think self-censoring. No. The guides I know who work in Spanish or English elsewhere in Spain are absolutely not self-censoring. And in fact, they are stronger than I am. Their message is stronger. It's just they're on, they know what side they're on. If that may, it's kind of, the trenches are clear, the battle lines are drawn. Where in Catalonia is kind of, the other side doesn't have relatively that much support. If that makes sense.
So I guess I'm wondering, and you maybe answered this partly at the beginning, you have this democratic memory law that's passed in 2022 that finally nullifies convictions, political convictions that go back to the Franco era. How much of a turning point is this? How much have things changed, if only in the past few years, or is the country just more polarized than ever?
It's more polarized than ever, is the answer to that. As you know, it's the it is a left-right thing. Well, it's a left and a regional nationalist on one side against the right. Now, some of the regional nationalists are also right-wing. But that's kind of how things go in Spain. And the more those who, the descendants, let's say, of those who lost the war have talked about it, this is going back to the first question now, have discussed things, have openly brought things into public view, have named stadiums, not just stadiums, hundreds of streets in Catalonia and squares are probably named after US companions and other Republican leaders. The more and more that's being done, the more and more, and all this new memory law or moving Franco from the Valley of the Fallen and all those other things that have happened, the more the right has reacted. So I think when things were not much was talked about, you know, that's okay. But the more and more it's brought out into the open to really to clean the democratic space. You know, how can you have a state where there's 115,000, 120,000 people in mass unmarked graves from just three generations ago? How can you have a state? How can you have a democratic conversation with that skeleton in the cupboard there? So I don't think it's, you know, the right's attitude is all, it's all, you know, it's, you're bringing up old, opening old wounds. This is so manifestly not true. Those wounds are open, have always been open. It's just that they've been festering on their own. And now at last, in the last 20, 25 years, more and more has been done to look at the wounds so you can bring closure. But unfortunately, instead of doing that, it is one of the things which is, or I don't want to use the word, it has ignited a memory war, but there is a memory war resulting from it because of the right's refusal to, or most of the Spanish nationalist right, let me just define which right we mean, refusal to come to terms with that, which, you know, in 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you would say, unlike elsewhere in Europe, you know, in Germany or France, where they, you know, they've come to terms with what, you know, what happened in the Second World War, and certainly that's no longer true. But it did seem, a German historian once told me that in France and in Germany, the Second World War is a settled history. It probably is settled history in Britain, whereas in Spanish Civil War, it's an ongoing process. And that was a really interesting thing to say 10 years ago. I don't think it's true anymore, is it? It's happening everywhere.
Nick, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. I've been talking with Nick Lloyd, creator of Spanish Civil War Tours in Barcelona, which you can find at thespanishcivilwar.com. Nick is also author of Forgotten Places, Barcelona and the Spanish Civil War, and most recently, Travels Through the Spanish Civil War. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. Your support makes all the difference. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.